critical one in terms of the relationship between Yaakov and Esau. Chazal, in many, many different places, point out that the struggle that took place prenatally, if you will, which is embedded in the pasuk Chav Beis, the Torah says, "V'nisrael tzitzu habanim b'kirba." There was a struggle going on within the womb of Rivka. Rashi even comments. A well-known Chazal, Rashi says, "Shoyso veras al pisnei Torah shoshem beiver Yaakov rots in the parkes lotes." When she passed, if it's medrash shoshem beiver, Yaakov's son now was, as it were, lunging forward to leave her womb. And when she passed al pisnei Torah shoshem, when she passed the church, Esau the parkes lotes. He was lunging to leave. There's a struggle taking place, and Rashi then quotes. The argument between Yaakov and Esau was really a struggle for two worlds. And this classic struggle, Chazal indicate, will continue until the coming of Moshiach. As a matter of fact, later on in Vayishlach, the Torah describes the encounter between Yaakov and Esau, and Esau attempts to somehow effect a rapprochement with Yaakov, because Yaakov, as you know, had more or less separated himself from Esau. If you look at Vayishlach, if you have a chumash, which is always kedai to bring this year, in Perek Lamed Gimel, Pasuk Yudalot, when Yaakov essentially deflects the attempts on the part of Esau to bring the two families together, and he tells him, after Esau in Pasuk Yudbeis, Perek Lamed Gimel says, "Nisav Leilecha Ve'Evon Leilecha," let's travel together. Yaakov's response is, "Hayuladim Rakim Batzon Labakar Alos Salai," I have young children and many flock, and therefore I cannot possibly keep up with you. Yabar No Adoni Lufnei Ado V'Ani Esnalo Liiti. I will travel slowly. L'Regel Hamloch Hashem Lufanai U'L'Regel Hayuladim Hashem Avol Adoni Seira. And eventually we will meet in Seir. And Rashi comments over here on this psukim. Says Rashi, when exactly will this meeting take place? B'nei HaMashiach. Shenema b'yom HaMashiach b'Hatzion Lishvud Hashem Yisrael v'Yisrael Hashem HaMlucha. So we have a struggle, coming back to the beginning of Tolos, that begins at the very outset, namely in the womb of Rivka, and continues, and this continuous struggle really reflects the dictum of Chazal, which Rabban in Lech Lecha develops this idea, and throughout his Perush Al HaTorah and Bereishis especially, the idea of Maaseh Avos Simu Levonim. Namely, the deeds of our forebears are signposts for our future. Rabban actually points out how if one examines the lives of the Avos and Imos, one will see more or less the outline of Jewish history throughout the millennium. And that's by examination of their lives. So in effect, the encounter between Yaakov and Esau is not simply an encounter between two personalities, but rather we're talking about an encounter between two nations, or as Chazal put it, between Yisrael and Edom, between Rome and Jerusalem, between two cultures, between two worlds that are separated by a gulf, by an abyss that's almost unbridgeable. And Chazal had the following comment. They say, Rome and Yerushalayim, if you take these two, Rome and Jerusalem, Im Yom Alecha Adam, Chorvu Shteyem Al Tami. If someone tells you both of them had, in effect, underwent Churban, destruction, don't believe them. Yoshvu Shteyem, both of them are established, both of them are prospering, Al Tami, don't believe them. Chorva Zov, the Yoshvu Zov, one is in the state of Churban, and one is in the state of prosperity, Tami, that person you should believe. In other words, it's not possible for both of these mighty titans, for both of these massive empires, to be both successful or the other way around. And the Chazal end with the following statement: She'ena achas mismales ela michurban chaverta. That means it's a seesaw kind of relationship. When the star of one rises, the star of the other one falls. One of the two is always sitting on top. There's a constant jockey for hegemony, for sovereignty. I imagine they still have in New York City seesaws. Are you familiar with that?
Carmelo.
Yeah.
When I was a youngster, so I used to actually play with my brothers on the seesaw, except I was a bit more aggressive than they were. And so I, generally speaking, found myself on the bottom, and they were on top. And usually I made them wait there to extend the period of time. And I got a lot of other options. Anyway, if we examine the vignette of this struggle between Yaakov and Esau, just to paint a picture of the two personalities, there's a lot that can actually emerge as far as examining Am Yisrael and Edom. Let's start from the very beginning, and here again, the psukim are very revealing, and here you have to read the psukim very, very carefully. The Torah actually begins the description, as I mentioned, when they were in their mother's womb, and it's all really embedded in one word, an unbelievable word. How do you translate that word? It's actually used in modern Hebrew today in different contexts, but how do you translate the word? Or how do they translate they, meaning the Oxcroll and others, the Minayim? What do they say?
Crush,
correct. The word ritzutz means to crush. Literally, there was an effort to crush each other. So I'll read you a period of Elazar, a very fascinating medrash. I'll translate some of it. The medrash says that when Yaakov and Esau were in the mother's womb, Yaakov says to his brother Esau, Shnei Olamos Sefaneinu, there are two worlds before us. Olam Hazeh and Olam Haba. There's this world and the world to come. This world, he said, is characterized by eating, by drinking, by business, by marriage, by having children. Olam Haba, the world to come, is devoid of all those elements. If you want, he says to Esau, you can take Olam Hazeh. You'll take this world as your share. And I'll take Olam Haba as my share. And the Medrash goes on to say, how do we see that? When Yaakov said to Esau, Michra Kayom is Mecharas Sali. Sell me the birthright. What in effect was he saying to him? Sell me Olam Haba. You take Olam Hazeh, this world, and I'll take Olam Haba. The Medrash continues. It says, at that moment, they're talking about prenatal. They are still both ensconced in the womb of Rivka. It says, Esau became a kofar and denied the notion of Tchias HaMesim. He denied the resurrection of the dead. And Esau said, Hinei Anochi Holech Lomos, Kolamos Ali Bechora, I'm going to die anyway. So who needs the Bechora? Who needs the birthright? At that moment, the Medrash says, that's how it ends, it says that Esau took his share in this world, took all of Hazeh, and Yaakov went ahead and took all of Abba. Well, the Medrash actually is a bit longer than that, but I only selected part of the Medrash. When you examine the characteristic streaks of the personalities of Yaakov and Esau, one sees the following. When Rivka carried Yaakov and Esau, she was told by Hashem, prophetically, Shnei Goyim Bevidnech, right in the very beginning of the Parsha, in Pasuk Chav Gimel, Shnei Goyim Bevidnech, there are two nations, Ushnei Leumim, Mimayach Yiparedo, the Rishonim here has a field there, distinguishing between these two terms, Goyim and Leumim, that needs a separate shiur by itself. But she's told, there are going to be two nations that will emerge, Ulaom Milom Yemots, Virab Yavot Zoyah, there will be a struggle. One is going to be subjected to the other, one will be subjugated to the other. Virab, the older one, is going to, in effect, be, shall we say, on top of the seesaw, and the other one will be on the bottom of the seesaw. He will prevail. Virab Yavot Zoyah. And before you know it, the pasuk says, Chavtalin, Vinei Somim Vivitam. They were twins, and then the Torah describes how each one emerged. Vayitze Harishon Admoni, Kulo Ki Adera Seyer, Vayikushmo Esau. The first one comes out, Esau. Esau is pursuit. That's the proper translation. Kulon Kehadar Seyah, H-I-R-S-U-T-E. And he's also of a ruddy demeanor. Admoni. Mashenkin Yaakov Avinu, as you see, doesn't have that kind of physical maturity. And that's a very stark contrast between the two. A bit later the Torah says, Vayigdalu anorim, Vayiyesav isho deyatsai yisodeh. I think Rav Moshe mentioned this morning, in the course of his sikha, and this is definitely true, the term Ish Tzayid, Ish Tzayid reminds us of which personality in Chumash? Nimrod. Nimrod, unquestionably. And Chazal actually even make the analogy between Esav and Nimrod, and Yaakov is an Ish Tam, Yoshev Ohavim. As a matter of fact, if you recall earlier in Chumash, when the Torah describes Nimrod, it describes him in the following way, Hu heichel liyos gibor baaretz, or yo gibor tzayin uzeh Hashem. Al kein yomer kinimrod gibor tzayin uzeh Hashem. He's a hunter, par excellence, and Esav also seems to have a similar kind of problem. A hunter, of course, is someone who is usually full of courage, someone who is emboldened to trap, to kill. He has to be strong, he has to be efficient. And the profession of hunting, as you probably know, is fraught with tension and the like. There's a famous Rashbam. The Rashbam actually comments right here in Toldos on the Pasuk, Lamed Beis. Hinei anochi holech lamus, v'lamus ali b'chorah. Esav says, I'm going to die. Who needs the b'chorah? So the Rashbam quotes, in the name of his grandfather Rashi, that Esav despaired of acquiring the b'chorah because as a hunter professionally, he feared he would not have much longevity. Why? Because there's a certain danger inherent in that profession. And he would die before his father. Interestingly enough, just there, Agav, based on this Rashbam, there's a famous tshuva of the Rebbe Yehuda, Rabbi Cheskel Landau, one of the great Dolei Yisrael who wrote Shutim that are very well known, the Rebbe Yehuda. He quotes this Rashbam in a tshuva, which is, I believe, quoted by the Mr. Tshuva in Yerodea, if I'm not mistaken. And it relates to the question of, can a Jew engage in hunting for a sport? What do you say? That's right. You put it in a very blunt way. No. Why is that? So he quotes the Rashbam because one is placing one's life in jeopardy. Many years ago, actually, many, many years ago, if I'm not mistaken, you should be wrestling what kind of football team? Not in my days. Already in my days, it was kind of rare, null and void. Why? So I heard, I don't know if this is true or not, it could be the whole story is simply without any foundation, but I heard, you know the old gymnasium in YU, in the high school building? The building that had the dome at one time? The dome at Washoe?
Still there.
The building is there.
The gym is still there.
So that was the gym in my days in YU. You know how high the ceiling is?
Very low.
That's correct. It's
like
about
this.
Half the size of this. I don't think it's this high.
It's a little
lower.
It is considerably lower because we were able to dunk the basketball without too much difficulty. I'm telling you, it was not, I don't recall it being high at all. But anyway, apparently at one time they used to play football. They played football in that gym and kind of ran. The results were catastrophic. And as a result, they decided to eliminate football, or tackle football in the gym, whatever it may be. But East Italian, as Esav described, is someone who is, as I said, clearly heroic and gallant. He tries to control his environment, he's not afraid of confrontation. I remember years ago, I met actually, I don't know exactly where it was, but for some reason, I met a Spanish matador. I think I remember now what the occasion was. At one time, I actually wanted to learn Spanish. I didn't have a problem. I picked it up in New York City without too much difficulty. In the Bronx. Yo hablo español un poco. But I speak Spanish somewhat. I've, unfortunately, most of it I've forgotten over the years. So I had the opportunity to meet a matador from Spain. Talking about someone who was in the ring with bullfighters. And I never really had appreciation for that particular, is it a sport? I'm not sure exactly what it is. It's a sport. I think they still do it, or in front of thousands of people who seem to get massive hana. I don't know, I'm not sure exactly what the nature of that hana is. It's not clear to me. People who are obviously gory and bloodthirsty and enjoy either the matador confronting the bull and doing that which he has to do, or Rahman and Slam the other way around. And then, of course, usually it's Vizcadel, Vizcadesh. But I was always amazed. So I met this Spanish matador, was very taken by him. I must have been about 7 or 8 years old. Couldn't be more than that. What was I taken by? He's describing in Spanish, which I haven't at that point speak rather fluently, about 7 or 8. I grew up with those fellas, those chaps. And my father also, spoke about 6, 7 languages fluently. Other than Spanish, he spoke quite well. And from time to time, he would speak to me in Spanish. Actually, I went, and when I was in YU, I decided to take a course in Spanish. But the fellow who taught the course was a Castilian, very aristocratic. And he looked down upon me as one of those, how shall I call it, plebeians, who spoke a very base and boorish kind of Spanish. He spoke a Castilian aristocratic kind of Spanish. I remember we read actually one novel that we read that year was from Miguel Unamuno, La Ciudad de Anonimia, the Society of Anonymity, about 1,000 pages of Spanish. I was not too happy with that novel. But whatever the case is, I'm going back to 7 or 8, so I met this matador, and he was describing, and he actually even wanted to bring a bull into the area where we were in order to show us, to demonstrate his talents and the like. But he reminded me of Mesa. That's what I do recall. A kind of Isodan. He's ready to confront nature, and of course he has developed a sixth sense for any predators or those that tear him apart. His life is a constant struggle, and with all the elements of Esau, still he's not a coward. He is the Isayid Isodan. Now Yaakov Avinu is described as Ishtam Yoshev Olim. How do you translate the word Tam? Ishtam? The way the Talmud translates it. And how does the Talmud translate the word Ishtam? Take a look. Very kedai to see that, because many, many people mistakenly translate it in a way which is really incorrect. Namely, Varshlim. What does it mean, Varshlim? Shalim. That's what the word means. Correct. As opposed to Simple Simon or something along those lines. Gvar Shlim, someone who is a Shalim Yoshiva. I think I mentioned it many times. It was many years ago. I brother it came out from Maxwell House and it translated. I thought, did I show you that, brother? Chacham HaOmer. What does the doctor say? It's really Chacham. You know, every mother wants her son, every Jewish mother, my son, the doctor. So it's Chacham HaOmer. They translate, what does the doctor say? Incredible. I have the Haggadah somewhere in my house, an old Maxwell House Haggadah from 50 years ago, and I kept it as one of my souvenirs. Actually, I have many, many Haggadahs. Every year I buy one to Haggadahs. According to my children, about 250 Haggadahs. I have many Haggadahs. Different Haggadahs I collect for different reasons. Anyway, the kids are, Yaakov is an Ishtar. He doesn't venture into the fields. He sits, he meditates. He's a more contemplative, reflective kind of lifestyle. I mean, he wants to be able to come close to Hashem Yisbarach. And in that sense, he is not as complete as Esau, but rather he's interested in constant self-improvement, constant growth. As a matter of fact, there's a medrash that Marabeg used to quote, that the word Esau is from connected to the word Asui. He's already made, he's already completed. Yaakov Avinu, on the contrary, has to grow, and has to emerge. And he's someone who really, shall we say, is constantly looking to develop himself. So Yaakov, we see in the pasuk is described as Ishtar, Esav is the Isayim, and the pasuk says Kisayim Befid. Now the reason why apparently Yitzhak felt Esav was the one who deserved to lead the Beis Avraham, because he had all of these courageous and heroic kind of qualities, gallantry, and undoubtedly I can imagine that Rivka liked Esav as well. The pasuk says here, Vayav Yitzhak is Esav Kisayim Befid, but Rivka is Yaakov. Mothers like all their children. That's a general rule of thumb. I'm not so sure the same can be said about fathers. I sometimes wonder. But Rivka and Yitzhak disagreed as to whom should be the individual who will transmit the message of Avinu. And the Torah tells us the story of the Bechorah, which the Rabban Chumash defines as the Avodas Hashem par excellence. And Esau saw it as valueless, looked at it with contempt. And Rivka realized that the one who has to transmit that is obviously Yaakov Avinu. And essentially what I'll tell you is the following, and this is based on the Ramban. The Ramban says that Esav personifies the individual who is actually looking for short-term gratification. This is essentially what this Dor is all about. Not just this Dor, it's the last Dor, and the Dor before that. And came out all the Doros, all the way to all the Marisha. Namely, what is such an individual? His desires have to be fulfilled and satisfied immediately. Otherwise he'll be frustrated. He suffers from what is known as a severe case of ennui. is a French word. E-N-N-U-R. That's a kind of fatigue. That's one of constant battle and tension with the natural elements. And the Torah actually comments the well-known pasuk, the day that Avraham Avinu passed away, there was the Sidas Avraham, Vayava Issa ben Asadim, the who? Oyev. And Oyev basically means he was tired of life. Chazal comment how many Averis he committed that day. It's a very beautiful medrash. And as Rabbi Elshin mentioned this morning, the pasuk says, Vayava Issa ben Yaakov, Halitaini no. Halitaini no means, as the Mishnah writes, stuff it down my throat. That day, according to Chazal, he skirmished with Nimrod and killed him, because Nimrod challenged him. And again, other Averis he committed, but the Lashon of Halitaini, as Rashi says, pour it down my throat. And the way the Mefarshim described the word Halitaini, we have a sense of someone who is, as I said, physically and mentally fatigued. He is essentially drained. The Rabban calls it the classical Zobel Vesobel. And Rabbi Elshin also mentioned the pasuk, which I believe is the Raya Mukhrachas for this Rabban. Namely, the pasuk says in Lama Dalit, V'yakov nasan le'esov, lechem l'zeh adoshim, and now look at the series of verbs that follow. Vayochal, vayesh, vayochal, vayelach, vayibez. You see that? That series of verbs is really an amazing format to be used by the Torah, and it clearly is being used, I believe, for a very clear reason. Namely, that here we have someone who has no appreciation of life. He's really lost his cheshek to live entirely. And I also want to stress, as Rabbi Elshin alluded to this morning, the word no. Halitaini no, the word no has two translations, perhaps even three, in Tanakh. The word no could either mean, please, or the word no can mean, now. What do you see no means now? Ona Hashem, Oshiyana, we ask Hashem to save us right now. So here, perhaps the term no can also be interpreted. Halitaini no means I want it now, without delay. Again, a demand for instant gratification. And Esav needs and desires have to be satisfied, not mañana, but pronto, right away. Or as they say, immediately. The reason why I don't speak Spanish is because everybody is English. Just like every Yiddish, I saw this used to speak a very, very sophisticated Yiddish. And I discovered after a little while that Yiddish, every Yiddish were English words. And that's why I speak Hebrew. There's my name no other. I speak Hebrew quite well. That's what people tell me. My shul, Hebrew today consists of modern Hebrew. It consists of three segments. 20% Hebrew. 50% Milim Vaziyot, English words, and the rest is slang. That's basically modern Hebrew. And that's why I speak it so well. Have you noticed that? You haven't... Echad Ritchelcha?
Tzat Tov.
Lomar Tovah Mibrit? Meze Bet Sefer Yigata?
Yula.
Yula. Shama. Ken? I mean, Shama, Lomdim Mibrit, Ein Shum Safek. No.
You're right.
Shama, Anashim, Mitzvianim, Tzachi. Yeah. Besides French, French is his mother tongue. But he speaks, don't you speak some Hebrew?
Yeah.
Where did you get your Hebrew from?
My French.
The French we know, that's of course.
English.
A little bit. English is that's quite good actually. Yeah. Speaks three languages quite well. Anyway, the word halitaini no means right now, without delay. And then the Torah, as I said, has this sentence, which of course is a very critical sentence. Anyway, the point I'm trying to make is that we have here two totally different personalities, and I think that's fairly obvious the way the Torah describes them in the psukim. Now, what is a fascinating comment, which I want to share with you, of Rav Shimshon and Paul Hirsch, Zedatar de Bracha. One of the most famous comments of Rav Shimshon and Paul Hirsch is found in this discussion. And he says that there's something here that is absolutely amiss. Something here not to say that. And what is that? The most important principle of Chinuch is what pasuk in Mishlei? Hanot l'nar, al pi nar. Every single person has to receive the chinuch, which is attuned to his or her personality, attributes, character traits, intellectual acuity, v'chul, v'chul, v'chul. What happened exactly over here? Says Rav Shem Shapal Hirsch, something here is amiss. Namely, both of them received the same chinuch. There was an attempt to take two personalities that are antithetical one to the other, almost I would say opposites in many respects, and to give them the same chinuch. And as a result, what happens when a person attempts to do that? You have a syndrome called the square peg in the round hole syndrome that ensues. Do you know what I'm referring to? I assume that's an expression. And that means you have here one person, when you attempt to put him in a midrash, namely Esav, Zelolech, it does not work. It's an error. It's a mistake. As a matter of fact, something even further which emerges here as well, there's quite an age barrier between Yitzchak and Rivka. Now, this is not a Shem Shafal Hirsch. This is Avishadid. The age barrier, according to Chazal, how old was Yitzchak? 40. How old is Rivka?
3 years old.
Even though there's no explicit reference to that, the text around, Rambam assumes that somehow 3 year olds there were considered to be more mature than they are today. I would imagine, given the nature of her behavior, the Chayisara, and the Chlal. But the fact of the matter is, there's quite an age barrier and a cultural gap between Yitzchak and Rivka. Beyond that, Yitzchak is an obedient, almost submissive kind of son. He submitted to the Akedah, dutifully, without challenging his father. And Rivka rolls up in an entirely different kind of background. She's surrounded by thieves and Shylock types, and shall we say, banditin levideim. You know what banditin means? Bandits. People who are essentially lacking in every ethical quality imaginable. And in such a case, where you have such an age barrier, and you have two different personalities, it's not unusual to see a lack of communication between father and mother. The one who actually points this out is the Netziv at the end of Parshat Chayisara, an astounding Netziv, who notes actually when they first met at the end of Chayisara. So the pasuk says that Bateres Yitzchok Batipo Me'al Agomo. By the way, Batipo does not mean she developed a camel, but she alighted from the camel. And then she says to Eliezer, Mi'ayisha Lazeh Alech Masalele Kvaseinu, who is this person? And of course he identifies that person as Adoni, my master. Yitzchok and the Netziv has an unbelievable comment over there. He said that she saw him at that point, he was engaged in tefillah, Gemara Brachos Levot Perek, Vayetzi Yitzchok Lasuach Pasodeh, the way Rashi quotes, and the Medrash, part of the Medrash. She saw him engaged in tefillah, she said, Tamal Adon Gavulu. She was so awed by his saintliness, by his radiant spiritual, by his majesty. From that point on, she was in awe of him for the rest of her life. And as a result, there was little communication between them. That's what the Netziv writes. Unbelievable Netziv. But I'm suggesting to you that we have here a lack of communication. And as a result, many, many things happen that really, shall we say, are the result of this, according to Hashem Shafal Hirsch, a lack of Hanach Nar al Pidarka. I just want to note the word "na" that I just mentioned a moment ago. As I said, really has two interpretations. As you pointed out, either it means "now" or it means "please." And I'm always fond of the following drasha that Rabbi Elshin mentioned. I wasn't going to mention it, but since he mentioned it, I decided not to mention it this morning. If you take a look at Vayishlach, just for a moment, something which really is very appealing to me, and that is that when Yaakov and Esav meet, and of course Yaakov showers Esav and his entourage with all kinds of presents and what have you, and Esav now is in a dialogue with Yaakov Avinu. I'm reading now paragraph of Beis, we have a Chumash, it's good to see this for a few moments. There it says the following. You have paragraph of Beis? Let's start with Pasuk Vav. Paragraph of Gil. In the next chapter. Paragraph of Gil, Pasuk Vav, after they hug and kiss, as it were, and they're crying, and it says, Vatigashka Ashrachos Heinu V'Yaldeh V'Tishtachavena, Pasuk Zayin, Vatigashka Ablea V'Yaldeh V'Yishtachavu, and then Yosef comes, V'Yomer, Mi L'chol Kol HaMachane Azeh Asher, V'Goshni V'Yom L'Nitzachem Yeni Adoni. I want to find favor in your eyes. V'Yomer Eitzav Yeshli Rav. I already have a lot. Achi Yilach HaShelach. You can keep what you have. And then we have the following pasuk, which always struck me as being strange. Pasuk Yud, Perek Lamed Gimel. Vayom Yaakov, Al No. Im No Matzah Sichein Neinecha Velokach Tim Nichasim Yavi. Please take the present that I want to shower you with. Ki Al Kein Raisi Fanecha, Ki Rose Panel Lokim Atitzeni. Kach No. Es Birchasi Asher Uvasoch, Ki Chanani Lokim Chiesh Yiko, Vayim Tzabo Vayiko. So he implored him to take it and he took it. The use of the word No, which by the way occurs here a number of times, some of we read actually the term no that's found in pasuk tes or yud rather al no and im no that's twice, and then the next pasuk, as I just mentioned, kach no and pasuk yudal the third time, and then look a bit later in pasuk yudal yav or no adoni lefnei ado the fourth time. So in pasuk tes vav the fifth time ayom ha'isav atzigo no imcha menam asher yiti. So I've always been troubled. Why is that term repeated so many times in the Torah in that context? So I just want to suggest, since I just mentioned a moment ago, I'll be taking no. That means right now, Esav is the Zol of Asova. He needs short-term gratification. His needs have to be satisfied miyad. And Yaakov responds, Al no, im no matzah sichein neinecha, kach no. What's the whole discussion? So I believe that you can interpret it along the following lines. Of course, simply you could say that there's a kind of politeness or refinement or civility in the conversation. That's the term no. That means please, as someone mentioned over here. But as I said, the word no also means without delay, right now. I'll give you another example. You have at the end of Parshas Baal Osva, in the tefillah of Moshe Rabbeinu launched on behalf of his sister, a sister, namely, what was the tefillah? Kael. No, refa, no, lo. The term no is used twice there. What does it mean the first time? Kill, no. Please, refa, no. Heal, now, my sister. So there, both terms actually are utilized. And perhaps here, what Yaakov is suggesting to Esav is the following. He's saying that my hashkafa is not reconcilable with yours. Your philosophy is founded upon no, immediate gratification. You have no patience. You are tired of life. You have to be satisfied, miyad. That's not my destiny. My destiny requires forbearance, requires patience. He says, Al no. I cannot travel with this philosophy of no, with immediate gratification. That's not what I'm all about. You know what I'm saying? I'm not saying this is the Tshuva Shel Mikra, but I have to like this chat. It's a bit homiletical, but Rabbanim generally engage in homiletics often, and I do that from time to time as well. So basically, what Yaakov Avinu says to Esav, that I don't have the same philosophy that you have. On the contrary, you want everything now, you want to be satisfied immediately. My sense of history is full of zigzags. I don't have a straight course with a clear, precise kind of path. And Esav continues to make a last-ditch effort to effect some rapprochement with Yaakov. Ayom Esav atzigo no yimcha means that, yes, we can come together. And Yaakov says, no, it's impossible. As a matter of fact, our Soloveitchik, Yechon Lugrafa, was very fond of the following very fascinating contrast between the life of Yaakov and the life of Esav. If you, for a moment, you are undoubtedly familiar with Esav as he appears in this week's Parsha, but then we also are familiar with another very striking, rather lengthy and elaborate description of Esav that's found at the end of which Parsha in the Torah where it describes all the alufim of Esav. The end of Vayishlach. Look for a moment at the end of Vayishlach. You have an unbelievable number of sukkim that describe all the princes and the entire family of Esav has emerged, all his progeny and the like. Take a look at the paragraph above for a second. The Elohim told us Esav who Edo, and then it begins to describe his wives, and then it goes further and indicates the children of Esav, and then you have, starting from Pasuk Tesvav, Ela Lufe ben Esav, a whole list. Why does the Torah spend so much time describing the progeny of Esav? Who cares? Why should this be of concern to us? So this is a well-known question asked by Chazal and the Medrash, asked by Rishonim, asked by the Kabbalists, and each one has a different approach. There's a Kabbalistic approach, there's a Midrashic approach, there's a Parshani approach of many of the Rishonim, but the Rav suggested the following. Notice how Esav builds an empire, almost with ease. We don't see any, shall we say, Holocaust, God forbid, or pogroms in the life of Esav. It seems to be such a almost, I would describe it as no tzar gidul bonim, no difficulties raising children, and he builds a massive empire. Massive. Torah at the end, after listening to all the alufim, Eva alufe Edom, the Moshrosim, the Arts Apuzasim, who Esav Avi Edom. And it's all embedded in one word, the word Tovos. This, by the way, part of it is this, it's found in the Sefer of Rav Soloveitchik, written by the Rashiv of Torah Shvaka. That the word Tovos implies what? Biological continuity. Tovos means generations. But the language that the Torah uses vis-a-vis Avraham Yitzchak Yaakov is not a language of Tovos. We don't find that they multiply numerically, exponentially, in a simple, unencumbered kind of fashion. On the contrary, their lives are essentially lives of Yisurim. There are difficulties. There are many, many challenges along the way. And of course, that is the ideal in many respects, because as we know, only from a challenging kind of environment does real growth emerge. And that is found in many psukim, as you can imagine. Azorim Bedima, Berina Yitzorim, and that's really the life of Yaakov Avinu. To a large extent, his life is not a life of a straight road without any shoals, without any rocks, without any encumbrances along the way. That seems to be the history of Esav. But Yaakov Avinu is completely different. And those Esav and Yaakov are really also antithetical one to the other. So the Rav pointed out something which is incredibly striking. There's a Rashi three times in Tanakh. That's what his father mentioned. Rashi is found in Bereshis. He's also found in Malachim Aleph Perek Ches. And you have the Chalukos HaMikdash, repeated in Divrei HaYamim again, when the Navi speaks of what happened with Shlomo HaMelech. And there, if you remember correctly, that the Navi speaks about the possibility of a non-Jew coming to Beis HaMikdash. The Beis HaMikdash is also accessible to non-Jews. He basically carried the Chalam. And there they mention explicitly. But Rashi points out something unbelievable. There's a distinction between a Jew and a non-Jew. A non-Jew comes to the Beis HaMikdash, let's say he asks Hashem for request X or request Y, and his request is not met affirmatively. So what is his reaction? Rashi says his reaction is, he kicks. He rejects the entire Beis HaMikdash. He discards the whole thing. It's a farce. It's obviously completely without any foundation whatsoever. Hashem, a Jew who comes to the Beis HaMikdash, doesn't always expect his tefillos to be answered. Sometimes our tefillos, unfortunately, are not answered. But even if they're not answered, the tefillos registered in Shabayim and has an impact. We don't know when the impact will come to the fore, when it will be realized, but in question, there's an impact. This is the distinction between, again, a Jew and a non-Jew. What is the Yisod? I believe the Yisod is what I said earlier, what the Ramban said. Namely, a non-Jew or Esav requires short-term gratification. Their needs, their tefillos have to be answered immediately. If they're not answered, by the way, they essentially reject and categorically dismiss the entire enterprise. It has no value, it's meaningless, it's a farce, it's a sham, it's a joke. And that's the distinction between a non-Jew and a Jew. A Jew doesn't operate that way. We operate with long-term gratification, but certainly not short-term gratification. It's almost the example I don't like to give always is, of course, the following. Certainly you're familiar with football, and there are two ways to get to the other side. One is through an 80-yard touchdown pass, which of course is glamorous and certainly something very exciting. And if it works, Baruch Hashem, that's great. How many percentage-wise, I don't have a statistical evidence to study of this, but I would venture to say that most of these 80-yard passes, let's say 70%, don't work. Either they're intercepted or simply the pass never gets to the intended receiver, maybe 30% work. Am I wrong or am I right? I'm just guessing at the statistics. I didn't do a study of it, I didn't examine it, but I would say that's the case. Years ago, I actually used to go to Portland, Maine, and sometimes Augusta, Maine. My mishpacha lives in Maine. I don't know what's there. And I would go to the New York Giants training camp. And there was actually, this goes back several decades ago, and there was a fellow who was a very well-known, at least then he was well-known, you probably never heard of him, Alex Webster. Alex Webster was a well-known fullback, the New York Giants. And I used to watch the scrimmages and how the blockers would actually pave the way for him to move towards the goalpost towards the other side, and it was clear there was tremendous chokhmah, you know, the Gemara Rosh Hashanah, that he has shaykh chokhmah, he made chokhmah. He doesn't have to. Here there was tremendous chokhmah, and I actually got a chance to meet him, and once he actually showed me the playbook, rather massive playbook, to say the least, with all kinds of different moves and what have you. And it's clear that it was a tremendous amount of chokhmah that was involved. And that, of course, is a much more difficult way of getting out to the goalpost. Leaves you perhaps gain 4 yards, then the screen pass over here, maybe another 2 or 3 yards, and then sometimes you end not getting a first down, sometimes you get a first down, and this way you, shall we say, you plow your way down to the other side of the goalpost, and it's a much more difficult, but ultimately, it may be more difficult, but ultimately it sticks to the ribs, and ultimately that is what counts far more than the glamorous 80-yard touchdown pass, which 70% of the time does not work. And I always maintain that this chat in Gemara Bava Basra, my favorite Masechta, where the Gemara says in the first paragraph, called Kutub Sarev Zalash Vigol. There's a question in Rishonah that I've discussed a few times. The Rambam was asked this, and Rishonah was asked, the Ritva talks about it as well. What's better? Is it better to give $1 to one person, to anani? Or is it better to divide the dollar to 100 pennies and give 100 pennies to 100 anani? So the Rambam Paskins, it's better to give 100 pennies to 100 anani. Why? Because the purpose of giving tzedakah is not just to be mahane the ani, but also to change and transform your personality. And the only way to do it is by what the Chinuch calls acharei ha'pu'ulos nimshachem ha'avavos. One pu'ula, a second pu'ula, a third pu'ula, the same action repeated many, many times has an impact on the individual who performs the action. The whole Sefer Chinuch is based on this yisod, and it's actually yisod in psychology. We're not getting into psychology right now, but unquestionably, this is a fundamental principle. That's exactly what the Hagdah, Alex Webster, was doing, the fullback. You know, Giants, that was the days of Frank Gifford, I don't know if you're familiar with him. So, well known tight ends and what have you. The kids are, that's the way to get down to the goalpost in a, shall we say, in a way that will impact the individual as opposed to the glamorous 80% touchdown throw, which, as I said, 7% of the time doesn't win. And I say that, that's the difference between Esau and Yaakov. Yaakov Avinu is someone who's willing to plow and little by little, first down, screen passes, blocking this, that, and ultimately get down to the goalpost. It's a longer, much more convoluted, and much more difficult kind of process, trek, if you will, but ultimately it's one that changes and transforms the individual. Hashem Ken Esav, short-term gratification, he wants those 80, shall we say, 80-yard touchdown passes, and he wants that quickly, and he wants it to work, and he wants it to work almost overnight, without any effort, without chokhmah. That's the fundamental distinction between Bal Yisrael and Mosalim. And that's why even, for example, learning a Bar Gemara is no simple matter. How does a person become a Lamed? How does one become a serious Ben Torah? Today one Rashi, tomorrow another Rashi, the third day a third Rashi, fourth day a fourth Rashi. I also review all the Rashis, I learn the Tosis on each Rashi, I go through the Gemara, I get a sense of the Sugya, of what should bother me when I read Rashi, what should bother me when I read Tosis. I review it, little by little, I begin to develop the Sodos in Moed, and then after I finish Moed, and Nashim, and the Zikin, and Kashim, and Taros. And before you know it, in about 65 years, I have become a Beis Talmud Chacham. And that's what it is. Based on Tosis too, this says that a person goes into the Beis Medrash, you become a Talmud Chacham. If you devote yourself, but of course it's a difficult process. There is no short-term gratification here. It doesn't exist. There are no easy routes. It's not an Esav approach. It has to be the approach of Yaakov Avinu. You have to grind out the yardage, as they say in football terminology. And if you use this approach, there's no question, you will be following the model of Yaakov Avinu, which of course is the model of Klal Yisrael, and hopefully the model will bring us to Yis Hashem Bekara and the Jewish Shem. Okay.